Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 56 of Underserved. This week in studio, I have with me Josh West, founder of Foundation.io. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Josh, thank you so much for coming down and joining us in studio today.
Thank you, Andrew. Really excited to be here.
Well, like a lot of folks, you got interested in technology because you went to work with Dad one day. What was that like?
Indeed. That was a really fun experience. Probably not for him, but for me. I remember it was a wonderful time back in maybe it was the late 80s, early, maybe 1990. Went to my father's office, and he had a computer set up in a central room, typical, you know, 13-inch max monitor size, I don't know, orange text, black screen, a prompt, and that's it. And I say, Daddy, what's that? And don't touch that. But what is it? You know, he's like, it's a computer for the office. Don't touch that. But I'm certainly very curious and interested and young and bored, and so I want to understand what it is. I'm asking him, what is this cursor? What is this prompt? You know, it says password, and it's flashing, and it wants me to, I'm assuming, enter a password. I mean, of course. And I said, Daddy, what's the password? And he's like, I don't know. Don't touch that. And I said, okay. And so I'm just sitting there, and I'm like, well, I don't know. Password, P-A-S-S-W-O-R-D. Let's try this out, see how it goes. And I type that in and, you know, just messing around with it, push enter. System enters. I'm in the whole prompt. I'm in everything. My dad panics. He freaks out because this is running his business, you know, at his office. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what I did. I probably just learned to read like a year before, but I could type what's right there and I understand the letters. And sure enough, that's what set it off. I was interested and hooked from then on as to what systems do. What is this thing? How does it work? What can it do? What can I build with it? And how does it function? And so forth. And so that was it. That kicked it off.
Oh, your first brute force password hack.
It was password. Yeah. How cute, right? But hey, but I think back in the, what, in the 80s and 90s, I mean, that's what the password was everywhere, right?
Yeah, that or like 123, 123.
Yep. Eventually we got wise and we changed it to default or admin.
So do you end up taking some computer classes in middle school or high school?
No, not computer classes. It was all mess around myself. You know, I got a PC at home and, you know, we had in middle school, it was a PC with Windows 3.1 and eventually the big 95 came out, but, you know, using AOL for dial-up networking and connecting to the internet and, well, before the even connecting to the internet, right? Just the AOL community. But that was it. It was always self-taught, always just with friends, messing around, trying to understand things, mostly games back then, you know, Doom, Wolfenstein, right?
Is this the 1990s as Linux is coming of age?
Indeed.
Is that where you're cutting your teeth?
Yeah. So I'm getting into computers more heavily at that point. The internet, trying to figure things out. And I had a PC at home. It was like a 200 megahertz Intel processor. And I had a 2 gigabyte hard drive in that machine. And I wanted to understand Linux. I was at Staples, I think, you know, one year for back to school shopping. And I found a book. It was on Linux. And I said to my mom, Mom, can we buy this? She's like, what is it? I'm like, it's Linux. Okay. She's like, all right, fine. You know, I had the CD in the back and Red Hat Linux. I mean, Red Hat, not RHEL, but Red Hat Linux back in the day. And so it was like Sam's learn Linux in 24 hours or 20, whatever. It was like, I'll do it in 2. But it was a challenge accepted, but it was fun. So I got that machine reformatted and got it set up and got Linux going back with the original Red Hat, you know, with the CDE desktop environment or perhaps a KDE, I don't even remember. I remember at that point just being like, okay, cool, I got Linux installed. I got a dual partition. It's set up. I mean, that's what everybody did. Not everybody, but we did.
The cool kids had dual boot.
The cool kids had dual boot, exactly. With Lilo and everything. Yeah, I got that set up. And then now what? I can't get on the internet. I can't use AOL. It doesn't work in Linux. Not even with Wine back in the day. So that was a fun, another month-long adventure trying to learn how to do ISA plug-and-play tools, get the modem working once the modem's working, connect to free ISPs like NetZero and decode their encryption so you could actually log in and without using their client. So that was a blast.
Now, are you communing with other programmer and hacker types on like IRC or any of the old school boards or chats?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, it was all IRC. FNET, Dialnet. I think someday Freenode came out, FNET and Dialnet. And yeah, that was it. And, you know, ICQ and some really cool communities that I was fortunate enough to be a member of, like Unix Gods, Anti-Offline. Got to meet some folks. I think most of them were a little bit older than I was, and some a couple my age. And I even met up with some of them at some point. It was fantastic. It was a community, actually an online forum community back in the day called Cyber Army. And that was a lot of fun. So I was involved with that. And, you know, it was just a bunch of kids with some forum. And we did little challenges of JavaScript things to get to the next level, to the next secret forum and discussion forum and work your way up to levels and everything. It was never nefarious. It was just fun little challenges, you know.
So you go to college in Pennsylvania at Lehigh?
Yeah, I went there for business because I figured I'd do computer stuff anyway. So I studied business information systems, and that was a blast. So started in 2000.
And so do you have any professors or from your business classes that were kind of formative or mentors or people that got you interested in things besides computers?
I wouldn't say it was a professor. It was actually an alumni who visited. It was a gentleman who, he started a web hosting company down in Pennsylvania called iNetU. Not sure where they are today. I'm sure he's sold it, doing other fantastic things, but he came to visit. There was a program, a business school program, where you could have alumni come visit and talk to you about their careers and what they're up to and their experiences and so forth. And it was wonderful to see that. And it was wonderful to hear that and to meet him and to understand what comes after school, what comes after college, or what could come after school or college. It was a elective program where you get to choose which person you'd like to meet and go talk and discuss, and folks from many different industries and different backgrounds. And I was just lucky and fortunate and happy that there was somebody in the web hosting industry who came in to talk about their experiences after they left Lehigh. And that was it. And I got to meet some of their engineers. We talked all about how things work. They were back into things like the precursors to virtualization of user mode Linux back in the day, before eventually like VMware and Xen and KVM really took over. And just those concepts, those introductions as to how you can virtualize components of Linux and why you do that and what you can do as a result of it were fascinating to me. Combined with the scale, the amount of users and systems and sites that are being hosted and how you can pack them into one machine. Just absolutely fascinating.
So you go back to your IS classes and they're giving you assignments like build an e-com website. So what do you do with that?
I built an e-com website. Except I took it a little literally. So I actually built the e-com website. Like, I mean, shopping cart, encryption, cookies, transactions, database, the whole real thing. Because it was fun. It was interesting. It wasn't work to me. It was just like, hey, this is a fun assignment. So that was really wonderful to present in class during our presentation day. Of course, it certainly flustered a little bit of the folks in the class as well, the other students, because they're like, what? I didn't know we had to build a real full web. How did you do that? Like, we didn't study any of this, but for me, it was just a blast. For the real assignment, I mean, it was just using some simple things just to understand the fundamentals and the concepts, but I coded the whole thing.
So the kids today would have said Josh was being extra.
Yeah, a little too extra on that.
But no, you know what? I'm going to say you weren't. You know what? If you're passionate about it and you want to take it further and you want to do 9 pieces of extra credit that weren't assigned because you thought it was interesting, go for it.
It wasn't to show off or to be extra. It was just because this was fun. I liked thinking through these problems and programming something to solve it and so forth. And, you know, how do I handle state and how do I handle a database and transactions to actually do the commit of the recording of a purchase or not, or so forth, and sessions and web servers and everything.
Now, while you were in college, you also attended Hackers on Planet Earth, the 2600 conference.
Indeed.
What was that like?
That was a blast. I was there with a buddy from college, a good friend of mine, but also meeting up with some of those folks from IRC just to see them in the flesh, see them in real life and get to know them and talk shop and, you know, say hello, put a name to the face and face to the name.
And was anyone there being extra or have any tech flexes?
You bet. So I remember being at the Pennsylvania Hotel. I forget.
Yeah, Hotel Pennsylvania.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And that's where the conference is being held. And it was big enough back then. There were several floors, all sorts of different areas and things going on and, you know, hacker competitions and everything. But at one point, we must have been on like 17th floor or something. I don't know. It was pretty high up there. We're in the lobby area of where the elevators are on the 17th floor. We're waiting sort of in an area to go somewhere else, to leave and go outside and to get on the elevator. And suddenly the elevator doors open and this dude rolls out on a Segway on the 17th floor in a hotel. And we're sitting there like, all right, come on. What are you doing? Why do you want a Segway on the 17th floor? Like, come on, man. I mean, you know, we're all geeks here, right? Like, dude, you can leave the Segway downstairs. It's okay. Actually, it turns out all of a sudden there was this big clamor. Everybody starts getting excited and they're like, oh my God, that's Woz. That's Steve Wozniak. That's Woz. And so everybody freaks out. It's like, okay, yeah, you get a pass.
A co-founder of Apple can get away with that crap.
But carry on, sir. Carry on. Please roll right this way.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So I actually went to Hackers on Planet Earth 10 years before that. I went to the first one in 1994 at Hotel Pennsylvania. Back then, they had a network you could get on, but it was coaxial cable. And I was more about the in-person meetups and seeing what other folks were up to. And, you know, there were some funny moments, like they were doing a social engineering thing where they called into AT&T and talked one of the techs into giving confidential stuff over the phone, which they bleeped out. During that, everyone's playing with their red boxes, trying to make their Radio Shack tone dialers.
Still have mine.
Make the noise of a quarter dropping into a payphone. Indeed. But the coolest thing I saw, some guy had, it's a headset that you would put on that had a little boom arm and then a screen that went over your eye. And it was basically like a projection screen. Mm-hmm. And it was monochrome. It was like red text on black. And it was running Linux on it. And he had on his hip a chordic input device that looked like a little piano keyboard. And he would play these chords and that would type letters on the command line.
That's pretty awesome.
In 94?
Yeah. Like,
that's mind-blowing.
That is quite far ahead. I wonder where that person is now.
Like, I really wonder where he is today.
Yeah. That conference, I had a great time, especially, you know, back then. But I feel so terrible now as an adult for those businesses that are anywhere in the proximity of this conference, because just turn off your internet.
It's worse at DEF CON.
I bet.
There's a hacker conference that happens. I don't know if they're still doing it annually in Vegas, but yeah, there's a whole bunch of white hat folks and black hat folks there stealing credit cards by RFID readers and God knows what. So yeah, you better be on lockdown. So you graduate. What's your first job out of school?
So after school, I came back north up to the Boston area and worked for a company called Boston Engineering Corporation. That was a wonderful experience. It was a very difficult job, one of the most difficult jobs I've had, not because of any reasons other than myself. I had a lot of learning to do, right? And welcome to the real world. Get your butt in the chair at 8 a.m. and get typing. And you got deliverables and real projects. And you got to not only do the work, but manage the work and learn to manage the work. And they don't teach that stuff in school. I had a lot of experience with internships in high school and college at tech companies, which was wonderful from a technical perspective, but not from a necessarily process perspective where you actually learn how to function in a company. So it was a wonderful growth opportunity for me. I learned so much, got introduced to some fantastic concepts, like even more with virtualization and Xen. And it was a Linux systems administration job. So it was really about managing the Linux servers and all the software. And this is in the pre-AWS days. I mean, I think AWS came out a little bit shortly thereafter, and that was the first EC2 classic capabilities with here's your VM, and it has an IP address, and you can go from there, but not the modern concepts we have today. So it was artisanal. It was handcrafted systems administration back in the day. There really weren't any standards. It was, you made it up.
Yep. And then after that, you went on to Brandeis?
Indeed. Yeah. So after Boston Engineering, I went over to Brandeis University and I worked there, almost 5 years or so. And that was a wonderful experience. It was a great team and our networks and systems department. I keep in touch with many of the folks still from Brandeis. And essentially, we were responsible for the networks and systems of the entire university. And so if you think about it, it was the equivalent of a platform team these days where we manage the data centers, we manage the network, we manage, you know, the power supplies, we manage the servers, the system that hosted the directory, the storage, the email, right, for the university, you know. So once again, I mean, that's, 2006 or so. So it's still artisanal setups. It's handcrafted, you compiled send mail. And then eventually your big upgrade was to PostFix. Your spam filters were unique to your institution. You made those, you set them up. And Whether or not you got spam was dependent on the systems administrators of whatever company or university you were at that point. But that was fantastic. We had multiple data centers, brought in Zen virtualization into there, and so we could migrate virtual machines across our data centers, you know, live because we had the network span, decouple from storage. And it was such an exciting time to think about the opportunities and the capabilities that we had there. I mean, that was a pretty cutting edge department and setup we had going on with virtualization at a university across data centers with failover and high availability and so forth. That was pretty cutting edge stuff, and it was wonderful.
You were definitely ahead of your time there. You rolled your own network registration system too, right?
Indeed, yes. That was a great project. We did a nice evaluation as to, all right, where do we go from here? We had a network registration system that somebody else had built that was just time to upgrade it to keep it going. So we did a pretty cool evaluation of all sorts of different solutions back in, maybe at that point, it's 2008, 2009, 2010, something like that. Commercial solutions is the evolution. Generally speaking, you know, you have custom solutions and eventually you get to commercial solutions and you get to commodity solutions. And there certainly wasn't much commodity back in the day. It was either custom or commercial. So we did a nice evaluation. We looked at the cost, the benefit analysis, and we decided to write one in-house, just given the basic nature of it. I mean, it's really, we controlled the entire fabric. We did all the networks, all the Wi-Fi, all the DHCP, all the DNS and everything. So it was a custom written network registration system I did in Python that used the ISC DHCPD API, which was called OM API, Object Management API. And it was a way to manage the DHCP lease object data structures as they were in flight with the DHCP servers in memory and combined with DHCP servers being balanced and sharing state. But, you know, it was a pretty awesome project and able to have an artisanal, once again, handcrafted network registration system for all the devices, from Xboxes to laptops to PCs to students to faculty and staff to the whole thing.
See, it goes back to that IS class. Now you had to be extra at your job in order to get all those things done.
It was fun. It was just coding that thing on a Friday night, you know, at 10 p.m. where my friends are out at the bar. I'm just like, no, this is more interesting. But it was a blast. I think even the screenshots of that network registration system are still on one of their websites.
Nice. After that, you spent some time at TripAdvisor?
Indeed. So TripAdvisor kind of came up to, I don't know, I'm about 5 years or so at Brandeis. It was just time to do something else, do something different. And I went over to TripAdvisor, actually not far from here, their office. Back in the day, it was on Needham Street. And I know they've moved since, but that was a short but fantastic stint. It was working in their corporate IT department, working on their mail systems and everything, bringing my experience from Brandeis. But, you know, we did a lot with Zimbra at that point, Zimbra mail system from another system. And once again, it was multiple data centers, physical data centers that were on-premise for the office equipment, several of them as well as locations in Virginia and everything. That was a wonderful experience. It was only short just because an opportunity came up for us to move to Europe, me and my wife.
An offer you couldn't refuse.
Just couldn't.
What was that like?
Yeah. So about 6 months into TripAdvisor, having a great time, doing some great work with some great people, great company. It was just an opportunity to go over to Copenhagen in Denmark. And so my wife, she had a fantastic opportunity with the company she was with, a biotechnology company, to relocate us over there. So we took a trip. You know, we took a visit for a week or so just to get to know the city, make a decision, see what it's like, put us in a hotel. And during that time, she was busy with the corporate events. You know, I started knocking on some doors and reached out to one company through a Danish IRC channel and said, hey, anybody hiring? And then some people said, yeah, come on in, let's talk. Found some other ones just by Googling of Linux Copenhagen, web hosting Copenhagen. Tech companies go, you know, what's popular, see their job posting, see if anything would be a good fit. And I was fortunate, actually, enough to find a company called One.com, O-N-E.com. Very big web hosting company in Europe. And wow, that was a phenomenal experience. What a great team, great company, great work that we were doing. It was cutting edge, revolutionary. I mean, it was a dream for someone who loves systems that are complex, who loves large scale. I mean, that was it. My first assignment, I think, at that point was to upgrade a few hundred thousand or a million MySQL databases, right?
A million separate databases?
Indeed.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the first gig. I think it was given to me because I was the new guy and nobody else wanted to do it. So here you go. Let's see. You know, just writing automation to make sure it happens, to make sure it's safe. And you got to do this relatively short spans of times, if not live. to keep all those millions of customers happy. Their website's online.
Thank you so much for joining the Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? Can you see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute. Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
So if you have millions of customers, you must have millions of DDoS attacks going on.
All day, every day.
How do you handle it?
A lot of layers. Let's just put it that way. DDoSes are fascinating because they've been around for so long, but yet there's still a problem and it's just not easy to solve. So considering we had millions of customers and domains, that's a lot of targets on your back. Somebody with one of those websites is going to annoy somebody else on the internet who's got either a financial incentive or just for fun, a lot of time on their hands, decide to take them offline. And we were the target of lots and lots of attacks. But we had fantastic mitigation strategy that we built out, mitigation capabilities to prevent this from really ever being a problem. And it was only very rarely that it was something that, I got to stay late and swat away this attacker and mitigate it, with some little bit more handcrafted scripts and sauce, take care of problems.
Sometimes even the customers could be an issue though, right? And you ended up having to do egress mitigation as well.
Yeah. So when you have that many websites, as they're all hosting things that, where a customer can upload some scripts, like PHP scripts and everything, if a customer's account gets compromised because their password just was
password.
Things can happen. And so a attacker would want to leverage a web hosting company's internet presence as a source of attacks, if possible. And so an attacker would upload a script that just tried to do some sort of silly UDP flood or HTTP request flood or so forth. And so it was equally important to mitigate egress because you don't want to be the source of this traffic. You want to be a good internet citizen. You also want to protect your customers and the rest of your customers, right? If you start as a business, start getting firewalled on the internet because you're the source of attacks, that's a problem for all your other customers, right? So you don't, by all means, do not want that. So equally important to have egress filtering.
So if folks aren't familiar with DDoS or the term distributed denial of service, is basically where bad hackers on the internet find a bunch of different points that they can attack from, take them over through buffer overflow or password guessing or some sort of attack, and then orchestrate several different servers on the internet to all attack one server, just flooding it with some sort of traffic, like you mentioned, like UDP or HTTP requests. And a lot of folks, if they're in the hosting business, spend a good chunk of their time figuring out how to get around this.
Mm-hmm. All day, every day.
So from there, you do end up coming back to the States and doing some work for Bose?
Yeah. So I came back to the States, continued with One.com for a little bit to help them build out their presence in the United States, and then came back north up to Bose Corporation in Framingham, Mass. And what a fantastic experience that was. I had a good run of some really exciting opportunities. Great company. The first assignment actually I had there when I joined them was to work their research division. And so we were working on capabilities to collect metrics and some anonymized information about the usage of many of our home products. And that would be home speakers, home theater systems, as well as the app that integrates with it. Just to understand how it's being used, what internet radio stations are often frequented, what times of day, where is the traffic coming from? And so that was a great opportunity and a great project because I got to lead up the engineering for some cloud infrastructure to build this, to handle this, and to speak securely with our devices to collect this anonymized scrubbed information at scale, right? As you can imagine, Bose is popular. A lot of really good products. So as a result, that's a lot of stuff that's going to send you some statistics and information. As that comes through, you know, you need to handle 10, 20,000 requests per second and craft that out. And it was a great experience because, you know, Bose was new to AWS at the time. And so AWS account and got to set things up and make it happen, get it going and build it up. And just the beginnings, it was the tip of the iceberg of bringing that data in, because the data is interesting, but you got to do something with it, right? You got to look at it, you got to analyze it, you got to graph it, visualize it. And it opened the doors for a lot of possibilities for Bose to get a better feedback loop.
And from a tech perspective, you noticed, hey, I think this might be a good place to implement Kubernetes.
Well, it took off from there. I think that's when Bose realized, like, hey, there's an opportunity here to connect our devices, to connect our products, and to have an enriched experience beyond playing fantastic, high-quality sound. But let's take it to the next level. And of course, if you're going to do that, you need to integrate that with the cloud. And there's going to be all sorts of different experiences and also different services and different layers that might enrich your playback experience with better suggestion engines. It may just be the simple security and identity and registration and updates and management of your device's platform. And so what I'm talking about is a platform problem, because you need a capability for developers to securely build, develop, deploy, and operate services that can securely speak to devices, have devices securely speak with those services. So from a layer perspective, beneath all of that, you have many options, right, as to how to make this happen. You can have commercial platforms as a service. You can go full in on an ecosystem like Amazon Web Services or Azure or Google's ecosystem or others. You can do things on physical on-prem. You can do things in the cloud. And once you get from there, you have choices of, you know, do I do this with virtual machines in the cloud or with just base AMI images, or do I go completely the other direction and go completely all functions and serverless? And we did a wonderful evaluation as to what was the right option, and the most mature market at that point for solutions and containers was, and still is, the relevant solution. What we investigated from there was, where do we go? How do we organize and manage all these containers? How do we ship them onto the servers and run them and operate them and upgrade them? And did an investigation with Docker Swarm at the time. And it was a pretty nifty solution. It worked fine, but it was, you're rolling a lot of components yourself from figuring out how you're handling storage or integrating with your cloud vendor's storage or networking between the different machines so the containers can speak to each other, or how do you get the traffic in to your containers from the internet, your API ingress endpoints. So we built out a proof of concept with Docker Swarm, worked out fine, talked to everybody, everybody was on board, we liked it, but there was just something missing. It was too much underneath that you needed to do.
Too clunky,
right. There was a gentleman who had recommended taking a look at something called Kubernetes, a gentleman named Shashadri. And he had mentioned he heard about it was doing real well at some other shops of some other contacts that he had. He said, take a look at it. And so I did. And he was right. It solved all those problems that I was trying to solve by hand with Docker Swarm. One weekend, I just decided, like all the cool kids do, open up my computer on a weekend and start typing away and see if I can make this work. And I quickly was able to get a proof of concept set up that migrated our entire platform from Swarm to Kubernetes. And those Kubernetes version 1.5 had just dropped at that time. I came in the next week, talked to our director, David, and said, hey, so I got this thing. I think it's the right way to go. What do you think? He did his research. He came back and said, sounds great. It's already done and it's working and it's better and we can keep moving faster and that's important. So let's do that. We agreed that was the right path forward and it was history from then on.
I know Bose's been a big user of Kubernetes. I think we've helped them with a few projects there. And I've attended a talk that I think was given by one of your peers there at Bose about Kubernetes back when people used to get together in person.
Indeed. Yeah, I remember those days. Right? Bose was pretty fun. Every 2 years, it was a Bose technology conference. And it was engineers and folks from around the world that were employed at Bose got to come visit and speak. It was a mini conference for the company. And there was a lot of really fantastic technical tracks about how the engineering is working at the hardware level, what we're doing with analytics and machine learning and data science, you know, how we're doing our cloud platforms and cloud infrastructure. And so we always spoke at those. We were so excited.
That's cool. And from there, you spent some time at EasyCater?
Yes. So eventually, you know, it was just time to move on from Bo. It was a great experience, but I wanted to move more into leadership roles again. I like to bounce between those, from going full technical to full not technical and back and forth. And I found, as a whole, it just strengthens how I think about things across the board. You have to be in it. And so at EasyCater, I was their director of infrastructure, still within the infrastructure space, but a lot more on management and team building and leadership and growth and direction. So I was there. It's downtown Boston. Great company. Really cool office back when we could go. I think everybody's reopened these days, but great time there.
Now, were you kind of taking some of the lessons you'd learned, like even at your stint at TripAdvisor? I know you said that one thing stuck in your head, speed wins. How did you implement that idea at EasyCater?
Yeah. So Steve Coffer, in my short stint, is Steve Coffer, the CEO of TripAdvisor.
And underserved, guest number 13.
All right. check out that episode. He did this introductory session for all new employees. It was kind of like an AMA before there were AMAs. And during that session, you know, he gave a talk about the history of the company and welcome and so forth. And just to pass along the philosophies and styles of the business. And one of the things he said was speed wins. Speed wins. What do you mean? Speed wins. Just getting something out there safely, but getting it out there. Don't hold back. It's all about delivery. And I think the industry has caught up to what Steve was thinking, where the industry has really recognized that it is about delivery. It's about getting your software out there and getting it as quick as possibly delivered.
Into the hands of real users.
Into the hands of real users, exactly. And in order to make that happen, the impediment to delivery, the impediment to speed is a poor experience, a poor developer experience. When it's frustrating to write a new piece of software or test a new piece of software or deliver a new piece of software, it's slow. It's just, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to work on Friday night. Right. And I'm going to go do something else, or I'm not going to be as efficient while I'm at the office because this isn't fun. And let's face it, a lot of us are in this industry because it's fun. We like it. We enjoy it. This is what we do. You can't hold us back. We're going to do this no matter what, paid or not. That's what open source is all about, right? Or at least was, but it's all about the experience, the good developer experience. And if you make a good developer experience, developers will make some amazing, fantastic software and solutions in the most clever ways possible at incredible paces. So developer experience was something that we focused on heavily at EasyCater to make it easy or easier to deliver and deploy and operate different solutions, different features. And when you do that, you not only impact the business in one area, which is cool, you have new features, you have new things delivered that your customers could pay for, and great, it affects the bottom line that way. But it equally and heavily influences your culture, right? And I think that is often overlooked. And EasyCater did not overlook that. He took that very seriously. Many other companies overlook the importance of culture. And a culture where it's fun to write code and solutions and systems because it's easy and it's a good experience and it's exciting. And my goodness, I was able to write something that got automatically tested and deployed onto our platform. And it's live, you know, my first week at work, or and I can continue to do that, It's overlooked as to how important your culture is, your engineering culture. And EasyCater got that right. And we invested in that and it flourished as a result.
Yeah, I think that definitely pays dividends. I saw some companies in the early 2000s when I was an employee or consulting where you go there and you have to stand up these five different things on your local dev machine and it takes forever and no one's productive in under 2 weeks. And depending on how helpful the other folks are there, it may be hard to figure out exactly how do I get a piece of software written, tested, deployed. And yeah, that's frustrating for folks. And in a market like today's where it's super hot and the demand for engineering talent is as high as I've seen, like people come to your company and it's super hard to be productive and get their cool ideas into code and out to production. They might be like, well, you know, I've got four other offers.
Go work somewhere else where it's more fun and a lot easier to do what I want to do, which is what I would do anyway. You're totally right. The competition is so strong that you do need to have a really exciting story as to why come work at my business, why work at my company.
So you're still excited about Kubernetes today? What are you doing with it?
Yeah. So Kubernetes, I am a big fan of. I think of it these days as it's the new cloud operating system to start with. It no longer really matters my Linux or Windows in the server. It doesn't matter nearly as much as it used to, especially when you get into the different distributions of Linux. You know, my Red Hat shop or Debian shop. And I mean, even back in the day, I would evaluate, do I want to work at a company based on what their tech stack is and Linux distributions and so forth, as that impacts culture quite a bit too. But these days, can I run a container on the operating system? Do I have a kernel? Does it have network? A little bit of storage, CPU, memory, systemd, some logs. That's it. That's all I need. I need just the shim, the base layer to get Kubernetes running to then deploy containers onto that machine. And at that point, it doesn't matter what distribution of Linux you're using nearly as much. The fact that Windows has an exciting story surrounding containers and Kubernetes and virtualization. The fact that .NET Core runs on Linux, right? So your traditional Windows shop can write software that works on Linux servers. And no one cares because it's a great developer experience to deploy and test and deliver and ship that code. And nobody even needed to go to RegEdit or anything anywhere or some domain controller. Like, it doesn't matter anymore. So I think, and I'm not unique in this, but Kubernetes really has become the next layer as to how things are done. And it's all standardized and equalized on Kubernetes. The advancements in that ecosystem are pretty significant these days because of how well they integrate with cloud providers. There's a project that I've been heavily following for a few years. It actually just went 1.0, and that's called Cluster API. And the Cluster API project, it's a SIG for Kubernetes on Cluster API, is all about clusters as cattle. Right, being able to spin up a Kubernetes cluster and any cloud provider, integrated with any cloud provider, with a few lines of YAML, the whole stack, the whole infrastructure, a lot less artisanal stuff beneath the hood anymore. It's just a couple lines of YAML, an operator controller that uses the cloud's API, provider's APIs to spin something up. The fact that now you can have clusters, not just you or me, but everyone can have Kubernetes clusters so easily and so standardized, it's not custom or commercial. From a cloud provider's perspective of one cloud provider does it one way and another does it another way, it's all standard. Or it's even standardized across physical data centers, machines, Kubernetes clusters on physical hardware, machines as a service. It just paves the road for how speed can win. The fact that that's no longer a thing, it's no longer a big hurdle to set up a full Kubernetes cluster with everything I need on it, encryption, security, backups, what have you, and I can just deploy and get going, it's an exciting time. I often refer to Kubernetes as the great equalizer. I mean, it's really standardized. The industry is standardized on top of a lot of the cloud providers, public cloud providers. They're all working to differentiate themselves, to become unique and special. And Kubernetes is sort of doing the opposite, where it's like trying to standardize them all and trying to make them equal, which in turn pushes them to try to be better, which it's a good cycle. It's the balance.
It seems interesting to me because maybe you could use Kubernetes to truly abstract the cloud provider to the point where if AWS and Amazon piss you off, that you could just spin it up in Azure, move all your stuff over there and get a better rate or better service or move it to Google Cloud. I mean, you know, there's obviously data migration's a pain, but it sounds like it's definitely making it more of a commodity between the cloud providers and less friction to move.
Absolutely. And therefore, it forces the cloud providers to advance themselves, to work to differentiate, to make their thing better than the others. But lock-in is no longer an option. And so please, please, by all means, differentiate, make something better. We'll live migrate all of our containers onto that provider. Or maybe during the hours of 9 to 5, I don't know. But do it, we'll use it, build it, we will use it. But the fact that I don't have to, or that I'm forced or locked in, it's exciting for businesses. Not exciting for cloud providers, but it's exciting for companies that—
For their customers.
For their customers, right? And even just have strategies where you're migrating your workloads following the sun, and it just turns out that one cloud provider might be better in one region of the world than another in terms of whatever metrics you're measuring on, latency or cost or so forth. And have a go that way.
So with all this work with foundations and platforms, how does that lead to foundation.io?
Well, I think, you know, from our discussions, you've perhaps sensed the theme, which is I really do like that layer of infrastructure that supports the rest of the infrastructure, the foundation, haha, surprise, of it all, you know, and whether it be hosting or internal microservices or whatever, it's all about what's providing or connecting the software and the services to the internet at scale, securely, with efficiency and good experiences and so forth. And I think that for a long time, folks have tried to solve the problems when it comes to platforms and foundations. And that's why we have cloud providers. That's why we have books and tech talks and conferences and podcasts about this stuff, right? Because it's not easy. There's no one way to do it. I think that also foundations, the value of them are often overlooked. I think companies need a really good balance of folks on the side of development and folks on the side of operations. And too much on one side, it leads to some imbalance and some skew and some inefficiencies, whether it's today or a year from now. And you need a really good balance of that for developers to really do a good job at developing and platforms and infrastructure to do a really good job at providing the capabilities for operation, DevOps. What I focus on at Foundation.io is infrastructure and operations. It's about that foundational layer of everything that's beneath the proper experience to provide systems and solutions at scale that are secure and have a good experience. It uses and leverages a lot of the cutting edge, but still proven and mature techniques and solutions in the cloud native world, the cloud native landscape, I find to be the map, the blueprint of how to do things and what you can do in your menu, your shopping cart of solutions that are available from storage to container runtimes to networks to API gateways to functions to cloud providers and orchestration and automation, whatever it may be. But I do think that the foundation is really where businesses can fall apart after some amount of time. If they don't have a solid ground to stand on with their platforms, with their infrastructure, with where they're deploying their code, how they're deploying their code, how they're maintaining and operating, securing their code, if it's not done right, things will crumble and things will fall. And it's painful to watch and to see that over and over and over again with companies that had a great idea and spun something up and worked on it and just didn't do it right. It's a shame almost because it could have been something. It provided the foundation was solid, everything else would have succeeded. They wouldn't have been slowed down. They wouldn't have been held back. They could have delivered wonderful solutions. And so I don't know, I feel very passionate and strong about that space. And that's what I focus on with Foundation.io.
Yeah, I think a lot of organizations get very fixated on dev, and let's get features out, and may give short shrift to laying that solid foundation. But much like building a house, if you don't lay a solid foundation, you are not going to build an elegant, long-lasting house on top of it. You got to take some time, make the investment, and the ROI tends to be manyfold just through the developer productivity and being able to move fast.
Yep, absolutely. Spend that extra focus now on a proper foundation and it will see you through for years and years and years.
So when you step away from keyboard and you want to relax, you enjoy some fine brown liquor?
Indeed, sir. Indeed. I did bring a couple in today for us to enjoy and share. But yeah, actually, you know, even back after college, is when I started to get into the wonderful world of whiskeys and rums and Armagnacs and anything that's been in an oak barrel.
So a scotch and a bourbon fan in particular?
Scotch, bourbon, rye, rum, tequila, mezcal.
So I remember in the early 2000s, scotch was going through a boom and everyone's like, oh man, I wish I had a time machine and I could put some more in the barrels 12 to 18 years ago. And then bourbon took off in the 2010s. Do you have any kind of sneaky, not so expensive, but punch above their weight recommendations in either category?
Well, in bourbons, it's getting harder and harder these days, or for many days. It's such a hot market that the prices are exorbitant. However, I still think there are quite a few really fantastic bourbons that you can purchase and you can get without having to hustle and bustle and wait in line or build relationships with stores and so forth. I mean, there's some really exceptional whiskeys out there. If you want the standard commodity things that you can buy, things from Elijah Craig, whiskeys from Buffalo Trace Distillery like Eagle Rare, right? I think Eagle Rare is very underrated It's a lot softer. It's not as bold and brash as many as the others, but it's an exceptional, wonderful bourbon. But also stores. Stores do their own barrel picks, their private barrel picks, especially anything at cask strength.
So Buffalo Trace, they make several different bourbons, including the vaunted Pappy Van Winkle 23 that everyone's paying $2,000 a bottle for these days. They're a contract distiller, and they'll make stuff for other providers, and they also make their own in-house distillations. And their Buffalo Trace bourbon that you can find still for like $27-$30 a bottle is really good.
Yep. When I started with this stuff, it was there was Pappy Van Winkle that was available on the shelf, and I'd go into the store and buy my bottles of several of like, yeah, I'll take 2 15s and 3 20s. And yeah, they're like $50 each or something. You know, it was like,
now you have to give them your car.
Yeah. Yeah. I was into it with my roommates and friends, and because we liked it. It wasn't a big status symbol at that point, but it was exciting and fun and just good. We would buy cases of things like the coveted Buffalo Trace Antique Collection. And I mean cases, just like, all right, I'll take a case of each. And you paid $55 a bottle. But now it's hundreds or thousands. And if only we knew, right?
All right, what if someone's a Scotch drinker and likes like the PD Isla scotches? Do you have any recommendations there that won't break the bank?
Well, I mean, I think Lagavulin is just wonderful. The 16-year-old, the 12-year-old cask strength, there was the Offerman edition, Nick Offerman, that was really good, 11 years old whiskey. But that's not it. I mean, there's more. Lefroc is wonderful. Ardbeg is nice but pricey. I think Boonehaven is underrated. I think Kalila is really good.
I got a case of Kalila for $30 a bottle back in the day.
And now? Yeah. But Kalila, you know, it's a very big distillery. It's a little bit more industrial. I visited Isla for an Isla festival back in 2013. It's a 10-day-long festival where you just go to each distillery and go to a party at each shop. And each day, each distillery has their own event. And you get to try them out and everything. But that was a great trip. Kalila, I think, while it is a larger distillery, they make consistent, wonderful Scotch whiskey. It's actually quite amazing how consistent their spirit is. It's not easy to do that. I mean, this is batched, produced products, right? That is dependent on grains and harvests and seasons and everything. And then different oak and different woods and
peat moss used to do the smoking.
Exactly. Yeah. But yet, the consistency from Kalila is, it's an amazing operation like that.
Excellent. Well, Josh, thank you very much for coming down and joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you as well, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me here.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.